Maybe you don't see yourself as a crusading civil libertarian, but is there any one of us who'd be comfortable living in a country where the government could lock you up without you getting to know if there is evidence against you? Well, 8 years after 9/11, this issue is front and center as President Obama considers a new approach to terror detainees that could drop many of the legal protections that you thought were in the Constitution. Could what's called preventive detention be coming to a place near you? Alexandra Dean produced our report, part of a collaboration with our colleagues at the nonprofit investigative unit called ProPublica. Guantanamo stubbornly remains the international symbol of injustice. After all, almost all of its prisoners are still being held without charge. That's why the president has promised to shut it down by January. But what will he do with the detainees who might be dangerous, but he doesn't want to try in court?
We are not going to release anyone if it would endanger our national security.
Makes sense, right? But wait, when President Obama made this speech, he slipped in a bold proposal.
There may be a number of people who cannot be prosecuted for past crimes, in some cases because evidence may be tainted.
It was subtle, but at the heart of his speech, the president was saying this. The United States might lock up people on American soil without traditional charges or a trial, that is, preventive detention. It's not what they taught you in civics class or in law school. President Obama calls it prolonged detention, and critics say it's un-American. You know, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all that. So what would prolonged detention look like? Well, it turns out, Great Britain has done this before, in the 1970s, during the conflict in Northern Ireland, and then again after 9/11.
Well, the immediate reaction for anyone who's familiar with the British scene is, we've been there and we've done that.
Philippe Sands is an expert on international law and the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo. He says he has strongly advised the Obama administration it should look at other detention systems around the world before designing one for America.
Just last week, I was with folks from the Defense Department, and I said precisely this to them, and the response was, that's a terrific idea. We hadn't thought about that. And from that, I gleaned that there isn't that conversation taking place, that just as with Guantanamo, where there was a sort of unilateral, knee-jerk reaction of going off and setting this thing up without talking to people who'd been here before, we're on the cusp of doing the same thing again. So, pause, find out what works, find out what doesn't work, and then decide how to go ahead.
Since Great Britain has a long history of dealing with terrorism, we've come here to find out what has worked and what hasn't worked before the decision is made about how to proceed in the United States. Britain used to have a system of preventive detention in high-security prisons, similar to the one the president's considering for America. But in late 2004, that was deemed a violation of human rights and struck down. It was replaced with a form of house arrest known as control orders. Today, about 30 men are held under them. We came to East London to meet one of the men, Hussein al-Samamra. He's been locked up in a government house for a year. You're seeing him with his daughter on one of the few times he is allowed outside. He's a Palestinian from Jordan who came to the United Kingdom seeking political asylum 8 years ago. He started a business as a used car dealer. For 5 years, he lived in Birmingham, making repeated appeals for legal status as a refugee. Then, in 2006, the authorities imprisoned him. They seized his car and the rest of his assets. After 2 years, they put him under a control order here in London. No visitors are allowed inside his apartment without special clearance, but we can talk in the apartment's shared hallway. I wanted to know why he is being detained.
Why? I don't know. I'm not allowed to know. Even my lawyer, she's not allowed to know which evidence they have against me.
As we're talking, you still don't know what the complaint is.
I still don't know nothing. What did they have? And I still challenge them. I've done nothing wrong to be punished for.
Is it possible he's guilty of some crime? Maybe not. Or maybe, we just don't know. Most of the charges and evidence against him are secret. What Hussein can tell us is what it's like to live under a control order.
I am only allowed to go outside 2 hours in the morning, from 10 till 12. and 2 hours in the afternoon, from 1 till 3.
He has to wear an electronic tag, and he has to call a monitoring company when he leaves the house and when he comes back.
It's like
a wristwatch thing.
Yeah, it's like a wristwatch where they can't track me anywhere I go.
One thing he wants us to understand is that there is no privacy for anyone in his house. He believes even his conversations with his wife are recorded.
This house is bugged, fully bugged.
You think that thing's bugged?
Definitely. I call it a Big Brother house.
A Big Brother house?
Yes.
It's worse to be in prison. I mean, at least here you can play with your daughter.
You know, with them is worse, because when I was in the prison, at least they have like a bit of freedom. You know, they used to go out anytime they want.
His family also has to live under some restrictions. They are isolated and their communications are limited.
Because of what happened now, I mean, because of these conditions I'm in, even my wife, I mean, my daughter was punished too for nothing they have done.
And where is his wife now? She's heavily pregnant and she's in the hospital on suicide watch.
About 2 months ago, she was going to throw herself through the window. She wanted to kill herself.
Hussein takes his daughter Shema to see her mother whenever her visiting hours coincide with his 2 hours allowed outside the house.
My wife friends, they used to come and visit her time to time, bring their kids, play with Shema. But now, I mean, these things is can't be happened anymore.
It's clear that preventive detention can create a lot of collateral damage. Consider this. Hundreds of detainees at Guantanamo have been released, some innocent bystanders, who were handed over to American soldiers in exchange for bounty.
The great majority of people who had been brought into Guantanamo were totally useless.
Were totally useless cases.
Were totally useless cases. I mean, you know, a 90-year-old man who was on his way to his dentist somewhere in Afghanistan, who obviously didn't pose a threat to anyone, somehow gets hauled off by plane to Guantanamo and spends months, if not years, in Guantanamo.
Today, most of those, quote, mistakes have been released, but Gitmo still holds 230 prisoners, and independent reports have identified as many as 90 hard cases that could be detained indefinitely in American prisons. Hard cases are people the government wants to keep an eye on or who can't be tried because the evidence against them is too sensitive to reveal in court or was tainted by torture. We couldn't find anyone in the Obama administration willing to talk about their plans for a system of prolonged or preventive detention, but you should know that the idea has some vocal supporters. Harvard Law professor Jack Goldsmith was one of the first to propose such a system. He served in the Justice Department during the Bush administration.
You have, in the past, advocated some system for preventive detention in this country. Why do we need a system like that?
Well, first, I prefer to call it military detention because I think it puts it in the right context. In every war in which the United States has fought, the United States has asserted the power to detain members of the enemy. Not every member of the enemy whom we capture are we able to try and convict. And that doesn't mean that there's not a legitimate basis to hold them.
Okay, if we're going to set up some preventive detention, for instance, question number one, should it be a system that applies to people from abroad, or might it also apply to U.S. citizens?
There's no reason to think that the terrorist problem is limited to non-U.S. citizens. My own view is that we should design a system that could potentially include American citizens as well. You're more likely, if you're designing a system for U.S. citizens, to design a genuinely fair system.
So what if Americans could be arrested and put away without trial? After all, in Britain, control orders apply to British citizens and foreigners alike. Kerry Bullivant was among the first Britons to be put under house arrest. He grew up here in East London in a close-knit family with his mother Christine and his stepfather Philip. He'd been working toward a diploma in teaching English.
English to non-native speakers.
It's a high-level course. Because
how did a young man like him end up under house arrest for being a possible terrorist? A few years ago, Kerry was hanging out with a fast crowd and working at a nightclub. Just when he thought his life was getting out of control, a school friend introduced him to Islam and a more sober life.
What drew you to Islam? What does it do for you?
Islam gave me, it allowed me to unlock the strength within myself,
to be the person I should be and to be the best person I can be.
Several times a week, he comes to a local mosque to say his prayers. He says he has a moderate view of Islam. But in 2006, when he decided to fly to Syria, the British authorities were alerted he might be dangerous. At the airport, he was stopped and questioned. Kerry says he was going to the Middle East to learn Arabic and to do some humanitarian work. But it turns out he was traveling with a friend who had a troubling connection. His friend had an older brother who was on trial for terrorism.
Did you know that this guy had this shady brother?
No. I'd met the guy who I was traveling with at a game of football. We'd hit it off. He was a funny guy. And to say that because their brother was convicted with something, that they have the same ideas or the same things, is guilt by association.
The guy's older brother was really involved in some bad stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, guilt by association doesn't sound good on its face, but maybe it's an indicator of the kind of family you're dealing with.
If one person in the family did do something wrong, and he still proclaims his innocence on that, then that shouldn't besmirch a whole family.
Not long after getting questioned at Heathrow Airport, Kerry was placed under a control order. When his mother, Christine, found out, she was outraged.
I was being told he's on his way to Iraq or he's on his way to Afghanistan, he's going to fight against our boys, he's joining the insurgency.
Did you think that was likely?
No. I guess you'd have to know Kerry, but Kerry is completely non-violent.
The control order meant that every morning Kerry had to travel miles to register at a police station, and he says he grew increasingly frustrated not knowing the evidence against him.
Obviously, I would ask the police, do you even know why you're here doing this to me? And the police would be like, no, but we're reliably informed that the evidence against you is strong and very, very credible. And that in itself plays on your mind because you're like, I know I haven't done anything wrong. So what is it? What is it that they're saying is strong, credible evidence?
By the end of his first year in detention, Kerry's life was falling apart.
Most of my friends and community didn't want to know me because they didn't want to be linked, guilt by association, to someone who was a terrorist.
He was married and lived with his wife and her family, but his wife couldn't withstand the pressures of his control order, including frequent police raids at his house.
The stresses of having the police charging in whenever they wanted and go charging up into the bedrooms while they're still in their nightclothes and nightdresses and things. What could I say to them? As a husband, as a man, there was nothing I could do.
Kerry's wife left him. Weeks later, despite his control order, he simply ran away.
If you're so innocent, why did you take off and run? I mean, abscond. You took off one night and nobody knew where the heck you were for five long weeks.
Yeah. In hindsight, probably not my best move, to be honest. It was killing me seeing people that I cared and loved but hurt. Through no fault of their own, and because of something that was happening to me, and that I had no control over to stop.
After 5 weeks on the run, Kerry turned himself in. The reaction from the police was surprisingly laid back.
They were like, oh, well, he can come in on Monday morning. This is one of the 10 most wanted people, Saturday afternoon. Oh, it's okay, he can come in on Monday morning and hand himself in.
I had to go up to Belgravia police station. Knock on the window and say, hello, my name's Kerry Bullen, I'd like to hand myself in, please.
When his appeal finally came before a judge, he was allowed to see some of the evidence against him for the first time.
This is the problem with not telling people what your evidence is. You don't know what their explanation is either.
It turns out that Kerry's detention was partly based on something that he and his family had known about for ages but had completely dismissed. Kerry told us how one of his mother's friends got spooked by the idea that he was going to Syria and had contacted Scotland Yard.
My mom's friend, in a drunken state one night, decided that it's entirely likely that I might have been brainwashed and I'm a vulnerable young adult and why would I become a Muslim anyway? And she phoned my mum up the next morning apologising because she'd done it while she was completely blind drunk. And, I mean, this was the evidence that they used to, and I mean this when I say completely dismantled my life. They destroyed everything for that 2 years.
The judge at Kerry's hearing had access to all the secret evidence against him. And what was his verdict? Kerry was completely exonerated. The judge said, reasonable grounds for suspicion do not now exist. It follows that the control order cannot be upheld.
There was absolutely no basis for saying that I was a terrorist or that I'd ever been involved in terrorism. And to finally have my name cleared and vindicated like that was incredible.
For Kerry Bullivant and his family, the scars of the control order remain.
You didn't even know that they had this kind of mechanism of preventive detention. But as you learn more about it, it must have come as a surprise.
I think shock, shock. It's not a surprise, it's shock. Absolute outrage. Secret evidence, what the hell is that? You know, who said that was okay? In what society can you tell a person they're guilty of something or hold them as guilty of something but not tell them what it is? How would you feel?
In fact, Kerry feels that control orders like his have sparked deep anger and resentment in the Muslim community.
They're making the situation worse by encouraging radicalization. One of the things that worries me is that there might be somebody out there who goes up to young people in the mosque and says, look, this is an English person. Look at what they did to him. They did this, they did this, they did this. And it was not because of his race, because he's of their race. It's not because of anything but his religion, yeah? And you need to stand up for your religion and fight this oppression. And then you've got the first steps of radicalization there.
Since his control order was lifted, Kerry Bullivant has reconnected with old friends and old hobbies, like going dirt biking on the weekend. He's trying to get his life back to normal. The British government has never apologized for wrongly detaining him. His mother, Christine, has some cautionary words.
I would say to the American people, be really careful. Be really careful about what you sanction your government to introduce. Because once it's there, it's very difficult. You know, it's like the nuclear bomb. We can't unlearn the nuclear bomb once it's there. It's very difficult to undo it later.
Earlier this summer, Britain's highest court ruled that detainees under control orders must be able to see at least some of the charges against them. Legal expert Philippe Sands says the United States can learn from Britain's mistakes.
If you go into something that goes beyond what control orders do, imagine what the consequence is going to be. We have enough difficulties with control orders, which is on a very small number of people, and which nevertheless raises the most serious passions in a country that is committed to the idea of individual liberty, like the United States.
It's just hard for many Americans to swallow this notion that people in power with access to evidence they haven't fully shared think someone is a problem. It seems like a reversal of the basic presumption of innocent until proven guilty.
Well, I hope that's not what the system will look like. I hope it's a system where the government is forced to go and present evidence to independent parties to make sure he has done what we think he has done in a way that makes him a member of a group that needs to be detained.
But what will the prolonged detention that President Obama has proposed actually look like? Will it resemble the control orders practiced in Britain right now? Well, it's still being worked out. Might there be, for instance, some kind of trial or hearing? We asked Professor Goldsmith to sketch out his vision of what would happen to someone detained in the United States.
Will they be able to see much or all of the evidence against them?
Yeah, that's basically in the process of being worked out now by courts. And it doesn't sound like it'll be terribly, terribly different from what the Bush administration has been doing for the last 7 or 8 years, with the possible very large difference that they'll get Congress on board.
It's certainly a fraught system. I mean, there have been Supreme Court cases, people are wrestling with this.
No, there's no doubt that it's a system that's still not perfect.
What's the downside of regular court?
Most of it has to do with the very high procedural rights that we give to defendants, the very high burden of proof that we give to defendants when we're convicting them of ordinary trials and in peacetime context.
Goldsmith is also concerned that a regular trial might not bring about the right result.
Another reason why you might not want to use the trial system, because the trial system, to be legitimate, has to be able to have the possibility of acquitting someone of the crime.
So it's thought within the Obama administration that they might have to have a way of, if someone is found not guilty, no, they still hold him.
Under the military detention rationale. On the one hand, if someone is acquitted and you don't release them, then the legitimacy of the entire trial is brought into question. On the other hand, if someone is acquitted but there's plenty of information that the person is dangerous, it's extremely difficult to release that person.
So let's be clear. What Goldsmith is talking about is the possibility of establishing a system where some people would have no real possibility of release. And Philippe San says that is the most dangerous element of preventive detention.
The U.S. has a unique position around the world. There is no country that is more closely associated with the rule of law. That has given the United States, for good and for bad, a tremendous moral authority around the world. If the U.S. loses that moral authority, it will become that much more difficult for the United States to persuade others, and it needs others, in order to protect itself.
Today, President Obama has three task forces looking at what to do with Guantanamo and the detainees. The one that deals with preventive detention is supposed to report back in January. Keep a close eye on their recommendations, whether trials or hearings will be open to the public, how secret evidence will be handled, and, well, if there will be trials at all. Back in Britain, Hussein al-Samamra has appealed his case, but because his immigration status is in limbo, he still can't see all the evidence against him. In July, his wife gave birth to a son, but she's still suffering psychological problems. The conditions of the control order mean before the clock strikes noon, Hussein has to take the baby back to her in the hospital. You've said that your wife has felt this despair because of the situation. And what about you? Do you feel this way?
I'm thinking every day to just put an end for my life. But the only thing is holding me, my daughter and my wife. And I'm trying really hard to show them that I'm strong, I'm here for them. But inside of me, I'm burning.
The lot of a democracy is to fight with one hand tied behind its back, hostage to its own values, but the democracy is still stronger than those who face us down. And I think we need to keep our eye on the ball. We've got to keep our eye on our system of values, that no man or woman is deprived of liberty without due process. If that is gone, we become like those who seek to do us harm, and we don't make ourselves safer.